Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. Displacement by David Wong Louis. Mrs. Chow heard the widow. She tried reading faster, but kept stumbling over the same lines. She thought perhaps she was misreading them. There comes, then, finally, the prospect of atomic war. If the war is ever to be carried to China, common sense tells us only atomic weapons could promise maximum loss with minimum damage. When she heard the widow's wheelchair, she tossed a copy of Life down on the couch, afraid she might be found out. The year was 1952. Outside the kitchen, Chow was lathering the windows. He worked a soft brush in a circular motion. Inside, the widow was accusing Mrs. Chow of stealing her cookies. The widow had a handful of them clutched to her chest and brought one down hard against the table. She was counting. Chow waved, but Mrs. Chow only shook her head. He soaped up the last pane and disappeared. Standing accused, Mrs. Chow wondered if this was what it was like when her parents faced the liberators who had come to reclaim her family's property in the name of the people. She imagined her mother's response to them. What people? All of my servants are clothed and decently fed. The widow swept the cookies off the table as if they were a canasta trick one. She started counting again. Mrs. Chow and the widow had played out this scene many times before. As on other occasions, she didn't give the old woman the satisfaction of a plea, guilty or otherwise. Mrs. Chow ignored the widow's busy blue hands. She fixed her gaze on the woman's milky eyes instead. Sight resided at the peripheries. Mornings before she prepared the tub, emptied the piss pot, or fried the breakfast meat, Mrs. Chow cradled the widow's oily scalp and applied the yellow drops that preserved what vision was left in the cold, heaven-directed eyes. "Is she watching?" said the widow. She tilted her big gray head sideways, a few degrees in any direction. Mrs. Chow became a blur. In happier days, Mrs. Chow might have positioned herself just right or left of the center, nearly within a line of sight. Mrs. Chow was 35 years old. After a decade-long separation from her husband, she finally had entered the United States in 1950 under the joint auspices of the War Brides and Refugee Relief Acts. She would agree she was a bride, but not a refugee, even though the Red Army had confiscated her home and turned it into a technical school. During the trouble, she was away, safely studying in Hong Kong. Her parents, with all their wealth, could have easily escaped, but they were confident a few well-placed bribes among the Red Hooligans would put an end to the foolishness. Mrs. Chow assumed her parents now were dead. She had seen pictures in Life of minor landlords tried and executed for lesser crimes against the people. The widow's fondness for calling Mrs. Chow a thief began soon after the old woman broke her hip. At first, Mrs. Chow blamed the widow's madness on pain displacement. She had read in a textbook that a malady in one part of the body could show up as a pain in another locale. Sick kidneys, for instance, might surface as a mouthful of sore gums. The bad hip had weakened the widow's brain function. Mrs. Chow wanted to believe the crazy spells weren't the widow's fault, just as a baby soiling its diapers can't be blamed. But even a mother grows weary of changing them. "I live with a thief under my roof," the widow said to the kitchen. "I could yell at her, but why waste my breath?" When the widow was released from the hospital, she returned to the house with a live-in nurse. Soon afterward, her daughter paid a visit, and the widow told her she didn't want the nurse around any more. "She can do me," the widow said, pointing in Mrs. Chow's direction. "She won't cost a cent. Besides, I don't like being touched that way by a person who knows what she's touching," she said of the nurse. Nobody knew, but Mrs. Chow spoke a passable, though highly accented English she had learned in British schools. Her teachers in Hong Kong always said that if she had the language when she came to the States, she'd be treated better than other immigrants. Chow couldn't have agreed more. Once she arrived, he started to teach her everything he knew in English. But that amounted to very little, considering he had been here for more than 10 years. And what he had mastered came out of crudely and strangely twisted. His phrases, built from a vocabulary of deference and accommodation, irritated Mrs. Chow for the way they resembled the obsequious blabber of her servants back home. The Chows had been hired ostensibly to drive the widow to her canasta club, to clean the house, to do the shopping, and since a bad hip, to oversee her personal hygiene. In return, they lived rent-free upstairs in the children's rooms, 3 bedrooms and a large bath. Plenty of space, it would seem, except the widow wouldn't allow them to remove any of the toys and things from her children's cluttered rooms. On weekends and Tuesday afternoons, Chow borrowed the widow's tools and gardened for spending money. Friday nights, after they dropped the widow off at the Canasta Club, the Chows dined at Ming's and then went to the amusement park at the beach boardwalk. First and last, they got in line to ride the Milky Way. On the day the immigration authorities finally let Mrs. Chow go, before she even saw her new home, Chow took his bride to the boardwalk. He wanted to impress her with her new country. All that machinery, brainwork, and labor done for the sake of fun. He never tried the roller coaster before she arrived. He saved it for her. After that very first time, he realized he was much happier with his feet on the ground. But not Mrs. Chow. Oh, this speed, this thrust at the sky, this up! Oh, this raging, clattering, pushy country, so big! And since that first ride, she looked forward to Friday nights and the wind whipping through her hair, stinging her eyes, blowing away the top layers of dailiness. On the longest, most dangerous descent, her dry mouth would open to a silent O, and she would thrust up her arms as if she could fly away. Some nights, as the Chows waited in line, a gang of toughs out on a strut, trussed in denim and combs, would stop and visit. MacArthur, they said, will drain the Pacific. The H-bomb will wipe Korea clean of the commies. The Chows were to blame for Pearl Harbor. The Chows, they claimed, were Red Chinese spies. On occasion, overextending his skimpy English, Chow mounted a defense. He had served in the U.S. Army. His citizenship was blessed by the Department of War. He was a member of the American Legion. The toughs would laugh at the way he talked. Mrs. Chow cringed at his habit of addressing them as sirs. "Get out! Get out!" the widow hissed. She brought her fist down on the table. Cookies broke, fell to the floor. "Yes, Mrs.," said Mrs. Chow, thinking how she'd have to clean up the mess. The widow, whose great-great-great-grandfather had been a central figure within the faction advocating Washington's coronation, was 86 years old. Each day Mrs. Chow dispensed medications that kept her alive. At times, though, Mrs. Chow wondered if the widow would notice if she were handed an extra blue pill or one less red. Mrs. Chow filled an enamel-coated wash basin with warm water from the tap. "What's she doing?" said the widow. "Stealing my water now, is she?" Since Mrs. Chow first came into her service, the widow, with the exception of her hip, had avoided serious illness. But how she had aged! Her ears were enlarged, the opalescence in her eyes had spread, her hands worked as if they were chipped from glass. Some nights, awake in their twin-sized bed, Mrs. Chow would imagine old age as green liquid that seeped into a person's cells, where it coagulated and, with time, crumbled, caving in the cheeks and the breasts it had once supported. In the dark, she fretted that fluids from the widow's old body had taken refuge in her youthful cells. On such nights, she reached for Chow, touched him through the cool top sheet, and was comforted by the fit of her fingers in the shallows between his ribs. Mrs. Chow knelt at the foot of the wheelchair and set the wash basin on the floor. The widow laughed. "Where did my little thief go?" She laughed again, her eyes closing, her head dropping to her shoulder. "Now she's after my water. Better see if the tap's still there." Mrs. Chow abruptly swung aside the wheelchair's footrests and slipped off the widow's matted cloth slippers and dunked her puffy blue feet into the water. It was the widow's nap time, and before she could be put to bed, her physician prescribed a warm foot bath to stimulate circulation. Otherwise, in her sleep, her blood might settle comfortably in her toes. Chow was talking long distance to the widow's daughter in Texas. Earlier, the widow had told the daughter that the Chows were threatening again to leave. She apologized for her mother's latest spell of wildness. "Humor her," the daughter said. "She must have had another one of her little strokes." Later, Mrs. Chow told her husband she wanted to leave the widow. "My fingers," she said, snapping off the rubber gloves the magazine ads claimed would guarantee her beautiful hands into the next century. "I wasn't made for such work." As a girl, her parents had sent her to a Christian school for training in Western-style art. The authorities agreed she was talented. As expected, she excelled there. Her portrait of the king was chosen to hang in the school cafeteria. When the colonial minister of education on a tour of the school saw her painting, he requested a sitting with the gifted young artist. A date was set. The rumor said a successful sitting would bring her the ultimate fame, a trip to London to paint the royal family. But a month before the great day, she refused to do the minister's portrait. She gave no reason why. In fact, she stopped talking. The school administration was embarrassed, and her parents were furious. It was a great scandal, a mere child from a country at the edge of revolution, but medieval in its affection for authority, had snubbed the mighty British colonizers. She was sent home. Her parents first appealed to family pride, then they scolded and threatened her. She hid from them in a wardrobe, where her mother found her holding her fingers over lighted matches. The great day came and went, no more momentous than the hundreds that preceded it. That night her father apologized to the world for raising such a child. With a bamboo cane he struck her outstretched hand. Heaven help her if she let it fall 1 inch, and as her bones were young and still pliant, they didn't fracture or break, thus multiplying the blows she had to endure. "Who'd want you now?" her mother said. Her parents sent her to live with a servant family. She could return home when she was invited. On those rare occasions she refused to go. Many years passed before she met Chow, who had come to the estate seeking work. They were married on the condition he take her far away. He left for America, promising to send for her when he had saved enough money for her passage. She returned to Hong Kong and worked as a secretary. Later, she studied at the university. Now, as she talked about leaving the widow, it wasn't the chores or the old woman that she gave as a reason, though in the past she had complained the widow was a nuisance, an infantile brat born of an unwelcomed union. This time she said she had a project in mind, a great canvas of a yet undetermined subject. But that would come. Her imagination would return, she said, once she was away from that house. It was the morning of a late spring day. A silvery light filtered through the wall of eucalyptics and warmed the dew on the widow's roof, striking the plums and acacia, irises and lilies, in such a way that, blended with the heavy air and the noise of a thousand birds, one sensed the universe wasn't so vast, so cold, or so angry, and even Mrs. Chow suspected that it was a loving thing. Mrs. Chow had finished her morning chores. She was in the bathroom rinsing the smell of bacon from her hands. She couldn't wash deep enough, however, to rid her fingertips of perfumes from the widow's lotions and creams, which over the course of months had seeped indelibly into the whorls. But today her failure was less maddening. Today she was confident the odors would eventually fade. She could afford to be patient. They were going to interview for an apartment of their very own. "Is that new?" Chow asked, pointing to the blouse his wife had on. He adjusted his necktie against the starch collar of a white short-sleeved shirt which billowed out from baggy pinstriped slacks. His hair was slicked back with a fragrant pomade. "I think it's the daughter," said Mrs. Chow. "She won't miss it." Mrs. Chow smoothed the silk undershirt against her stomach. She guessed the shirt was as old as she was. The daughter probably had worn it in her teens. Narrow at the hips and the bust, it fit Mrs. Chow nicely. Such a slight figure, she believed, wasn't fit for labor. Chow saw no reason to leave the estate. He had found his wife what he thought was the ideal home, certainly not as grand as her parents' place, but one she'd feel comfortable in. Why move, he argued, when there were no approaching armies, no floods, no one telling them to go? Mrs. Chow understood. It was just that he was very Chinese and very peasant. Sometimes she would tease him. If the early Chinese sojourners who came to America were all Chows, she would say, the railroad wouldn't have been constructed, and Ohio would be all we know of California. The Chows were riding in the widow's green Buick. As they approached the apartment building, Mrs. Chow reapplied lipstick to her mouth. It was a modern two-story stucco building, painted pink, surrounded by asphalt, with aluminum windows and a flat roof that met the sky like an engineer's level. Because their friends lived in the apartment in question, the Chows were already familiar with its layout. They went to the manager's house at the rear of the property. Here the grounds were also asphalt. Very contemporary, no greenery anywhere. The closest things to trees were the clotheslines, posts, and crossbars. The manager's house was a tiny replica of the main building. Chow knocked on the screen door. A radio was on, and the smell of baking rushed past the wire mesh. A cat came to the door, followed by a girl. "I'm Velvet," she said. "This is high noon." She gave the cat's orange tail a tug. "She did this to me," said Velvet, throwing a wicked look at the room behind her. She picked at her hair, ragged as tossed salad. Someone apparently had cut it while the girl was in motion. She had gray, almost colorless eyes, which, taken with her hair, gave her the appearance of agitated smoke. A large woman emerged from the back room carrying a basket of laundry. She wasn't fat, but large in the way horses are large. Her face was round and pink, with fierce little eyes and hair the color of olive oil and dripping wet. Her arms were thick and white like soft tusks of ivory. "It's the people from China," Velvet said. The big woman nodded. "Open her up," she told the girl. "It's okay." The front room was a mess, cluttered with evidence of frantic living. This was, perhaps, entropy in its final stages. The Chow sat on the couch. From all around her, Mrs. Chow sensed a slow creep. The low ceiling seemed to be sinking. Cat hairs clung to clothing. A fine spray from the fish tank moistened her bare arm. No one said anything. It was as if they were sitting in a hospital waiting room. The girl watched the Chows. The large woman stared at a green radio at her elbow broadcasting news about the war. Every so often she looked suspiciously up at the Chows. "You know me," she said abruptly. "I'm Remora Cass." On her left, suspended in a swing, was the biggest, ugliest baby Mrs. Chow had ever seen. It was dozing, arms dangling, green melon head flung so far back that it appeared to be all nostrils and chins. "A pig boy," Mrs. Chow said in Chinese. Velvet jabbed two fingers into the baby's rubbery cheeks. Then she sprang back from the swing and executed a feral dance, all elbows and knees. She seemed incapable of holding her body still. She caught Mrs. Chow's eye. "This is Ed," she said. "He has no hair." Mrs. Chow nodded. "Quit," said Remora Cass, swatting at the girl as if she were a fly. Then the big woman looked at Mrs. Chow in the eye and said, "I know what you're thinking, and you're right. There's not a baby in the state bigger than Ed. 8 pounds, 12 ounces at birth, and he doubled that inside a month." She stopped, bringing her palms heavily down on her knees, and shook her wet head. "You don't understand me, do you?" Mrs. Chow was watching Velvet. "Quit that!" Remora Cass slapped the girl's hand away from the baby's face. "Times like this, I'd say it's a blessing my Aunt Eleanor's deaf," said Remora Cass. "I've gotten pretty good with sign language." From her overstuffed chair, she repeated in pantomime what she'd said about the baby. Velvet mimicked her mother's generous, sweeping movements. When Remora Cass caught sight of her, she added a left jab to the girl's head to her repertoire of gestures. Velvet slipped the punch with practiced ease, but the blow struck the swing set. Everyone tensed. Ed flapped his arms and went on sleeping. "Leave us alone," said Remora Cass, "before I really get mad." The girl chased down the cat and skipped towards the door. "I'm bored anyway," she said. Remora Cass asked the Chows questions, first about jobs and pets. Then she moved on to matters of politics and patriotism. "What's your feeling about the Red Chinese in Korea?" A standard question. "Terrible," said Chow, giving his standard answer. "I'm sorry, too much trouble." Mrs. Chow sat by quietly. She admired Chow's effort. She had studied the language, but he did the talking. She wanted to move, but he had to plead their case. It was his kin back home who benefited from the new regime, but he had to badmouth it. Remora Cass asked about children. "No, no, no," Chow said, answering as his friend Bach had coached him. His face was slightly flushed from the question. Chow wanted children, many children. But whenever he discussed the matter with his wife, she answered that she already had one, meaning the old woman, of course, and that she was enough. "Tell your wife later," the manager said, "what I'm about to tell you now. I don't care what jobs you do, just so long as you have them. What I say goes for the landlady. I'm willing to take a risk on you. Be nice to have a nice, quiet folks up there like Ricky and Bach. Rent paid up. I can live with anyone. Besides, I'm real partial to Chinese takeout. I know we'll do just right." The baby moaned, rolling its head from side to side. His mother stared at him as if in all the world there were just the two of them. Velvet came in holding a beach ball. She returned to her place beside the swing and started to hop, alternating legs with the beach ball held to her head. "She must be in some kind of pain," Mrs. Chow said to her husband. The girl mimicked the Chinese she heard. Mrs. Chow glared at Velvet as if she were the widow during one of her spells. The look froze the girl, standing on one leg. Then she said, "Can Ed come out to play?" Chow took hold of his wife's hand and squeezed it as he did to brace himself before the roller coaster's forward plunge. Then in a single, well-rehearsed motion, Remora Cass swept off her slipper and punched at the girl. Velvet masterfully sidestepped the slipper and let the beach ball fly. The slipper caught the swing set. The beach ball bounced off Ed's lap. The collisions released charged particles into the air that seemed to hold everyone in a momentary state of paralysis. The baby's eyes peeled open and he blinked at the ceiling. Soon his distended belly started rippling. He cried until he turned purple, then devoted his energy to maintaining that hue. Mrs. Chow had never heard anything as harrowing. She visualized his cry as large cubes forcing their way into her ears. Remora Cass picked Ed up and bounced on the balls of her feet. "You better start running," she said to Velvet, who already was on her way out the door. Remora Cass half smiled at the Chows over the baby's shoulder. "He'll quiet down sooner or later," she said. Growing up, Mrs. Chow was the youngest of five girls. She had to endure the mothering of her sisters, who at an early age were already in training for their future roles. Each married in her teens, plucked in turn by a Portuguese, a German, a Brit, and a New Yorker. They had many babies, but Mrs. Chow thought little of her sister's example. Even when her parents made life unbearable, she never indulged in the hope that a man, foreign or domestic, or a child, could save her from her unhappiness. From the kitchen, Remora Cass called Mrs. Chow. The big woman was busy with her baking. The baby was slung over her shoulder. "Let's try something," she said as she transferred the screaming Ed into Mrs. Chow's arms. Ed was a difficult package. Not only was he heavy and hot and sweaty, but he spat and squirmed like a sack of kittens. She tried to think of how it was done. She tried to think of how a baby was held. She remembered Romanesque Madonnas cradling their gentlemanly babies in art history textbooks. If she could get his head up by hers, that would be a start. Remora Cass told Mrs. Chow to try bouncing and showed her what she meant. "Makes him think he's still inside," she said. Ed emitted a long, sustained wail, then settled into a bout of hiccups. "You have a nice touch with him. He won't do that for just anyone." As the baby quieted, a pain rolled from the heel of Mrs. Chow's brain down through her pelvis to a southern terminus at the backs of her knees. She couldn't blame the baby entirely for her discomfort. He wanted only to escape. Animal instinct told him to leap from danger. She was the one better equipped to escape. She imagined invading soldiers murdering livestock and planting flags in the soil of her ancestral estate, as if it were itself a little nation. They make history by the slaughter of generations of her family. They discover her in the wardrobe, striking matches. They ask her where she's hidden her children, and she tells them there are none. They say good, they'll save ammunition, but also too bad, so young and never to know the pleasure of children, even if they'd have to murder them. Perhaps this would be the subject of her painting, a non-representational canvas that hinted at a world without light. Perhaps. Ed interrupted her thought. He had developed a new trick. "Whoop, whoop, whoop," he went, thrusting his pelvis against her sternum in the manner of an adult male in the act of mating. She called for Chow. Remora Cass slid a cookie sheet into the oven and then stuck a bottle of baby formula into Ed's mouth. He drained it instantly. "You do have a way with him," said Remora Cass. They walked into the front room. The baby was sleepy and dripping curds on his mother's shoulder. Under the swing high noon, the cat was licking the nipple of an abandoned bottle. "Scat," she said. "Now where's my wash gone to?" she asked the room. "What's she up to now?" She scanned the little room, big feet planted in the deep brown shag carpet, hands on her beefy hips, baby slung over her shoulder like a pelt. "Velvet," she started. That was all. Her jaw locked, her gums gleamed, her eyes rolled into her skull. Her head flopped backward as if at the back of her neck there was a great hinge. Then she yawned, and the walls seemed to shake. Remora Cass rubbed her eyes. "I'm bushed," she said. Mrs. Chow went over to the screen door. Chow and the girl were at the clothesline. Except for their hands and legs, they were hidden behind a bedsheet. The girl's feet were in constant motion. From the basket, her hands picked up pieces of laundry which Chow's hands then clipped to the line. "Her daddy's hardly ever here," Remora Cass said. "Works all hours, he does. He has to." She patted Ed on the back, then rubbed her eyes again. "Looks like Velvet's found a friend. She won't do that with anyone. You two are naturals with my two. You should get some of your own." She looked over at Mrs. Chow and laughed. "Maybe it's best you didn't get that. Here." She set the baby on Mrs. Chow's shoulder. "This is what it's like when they're sleeping." Before leaving, the Chows went to look at Ricky and Bach's apartment. They climbed up the stairs. No one was home. Ricky and Bach had barely started to pack. Bach's naked man, surrounded by an assortment of spears and arrows, was still hanging on the living room wall. Bach had paid good money for the photograph. An Aboriginal gent stares into the camera. He's smiling. His teeth are good and large, and in his palms he's holding his sex out like a prize eel. Mrs. Chow looked at the photograph for as long as it was discreetly possible before she averted her eyes and made her usual remark about Bach's tastes. Beyond the building's edge, she saw the manager's cottage, bleached white in the sun. Outside the front door, Remora Cass sat in a folding chair, her eyes shut, her pie-tin face turned up to catch the rays, while Velvet, her feet anchored to the asphalt, rolled her mother's hair in pink curlers. Between the big woman's legs, the baby lay in a wicker basket. He was quietly rocking from side to side. Remora Cass's chest rose and fell in the rhythm of sleep. Driving home, they passed the boardwalk, and Mrs. Chow asked if they might stop. Chow refused to ride the roller coaster in the daytime, no matter how much Mrs. Chow teased. It was hard enough at night, when the heights from which the cars fell were lit by a few rows of bulbs. As he handed her an orange ticket, Chow said, "A drunk doesn't look in mirrors." The Milky Way clattered into the terminus. After she boarded the ride, she watched Chow, who had wandered from the loading platform and was standing beside a popcorn wagon looking up at a billboard. His hands were deep in the pockets of his trousers, his legs crossed at the shins. That had been his pose, the brim of his hat low on his brow, as he waited for her finally to pass through the gates of immigration. "Go on," the old woman said. "You'll be glad you did." The old woman nudged her young charge toward the empty seat in Mrs. Chow's car. "Go on, she won't bite." The girl looked back at the old woman. "Grandmother," she said, and then reluctantly climbed in beside Mrs. Chow. Once the attendant strapped the girl in, she turned from her grandmother and stared at her new companion. The machine jerked away from the platform. They were climbing the first ascent when Mrs. Chow snuck a look at the girl. She was met by the clearest eyes she had ever known, eyes that didn't shy from the encounter. The girl's pupils, despite the bright sun, were fully dilated, stretched with fear. Now that she had Mrs. Chow's attention, she turned her gaze slowly toward the vertical track ahead. Mrs. Chow looked beyond the summit to the empty blue sky. Within seconds, they tumbled through that plain and plunged downward, the cars flung suddenly left and right, centrifugal force throwing Mrs. Chow against the girl's rigid body. She was surprised by Chow's absence. "It's gravity that makes the stomach fly, that causes the liver to flutter. It's the body catching up with the speed of falling." Until today, she had never known such sensations. Today there was a weightiness at her core, like a hard, concentrated pull inward, as if an incision had been made and a fist-sized magnet embedded. Her arms flew up, two weak wings cutting the rush of wind. But it wasn't the old sensation this time, not the familiar embrace of the whole fleeting continent, but a grasp at something once there, now lost. Chow had moved into position to see the riders' faces as they careened down the steepest stretch of track. Whenever he was up there with her, his eyes were clenched and his scream so wild and his grip on his life so tenuous that he never noticed her expression. At the top of the rise, the car seemed to stop momentarily, but then up and over, tumbling down at what appeared, from his safe vantage point, a surprisingly slow speed. Arms shot up. The machine whooshed past him, preceded a split second earlier by the rider's collective scream. And for the first time, Chow thought he heard her, she who loved this torture so, scream too. As she was whipped skyward once more, her arms were wrapped around the little girl, not in flight, not soaring, but anchored by another's being, as her parents stood against the liberators to protect their land. Some curves, a gentle dip, one last sharp bend, and the ride rumbled to rest. The girl's breath was warm against Mrs. Chow's neck. For a moment longer she held on to the girl, whose small ribs were as thin as paintbrushes. The Chows walked to the edge of the platform. He looked up at the billboard he had noticed earlier. It was a picture of an American woman with bright red hair, large red lips, and a slightly upturned nose. A fur was draped around her neck, pearls cut across her throat. "What do you suppose they're selling?" he asked. His wife pointed at the billboard. She read aloud what was printed there. No other home permanent wave looks, feels, behaves so much like naturally curly hair. She then gave a quick translation and asked what he thought of her curling her hair. He made no reply. For some time now he couldn't lift his eyes from her. "I won't do it," she said, "but what do you say?" She turned away from him and stared a long time at the face on the billboard and then at the beach on the other side of the boardwalk and at the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and at the horizon where all lines of sight converge, before she realized the land on the other side wouldn't come into view. And that story was Displacement by David Wong Louie from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Lori Moore. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, Those Are His Brothers by Nancy Hale. The long, clear American summer passed slowly, dreaming over the Connecticut Valley and the sound square houses under the elms and the broad living fields, and over the people there that came and went and lay and sat still, with purpose and without, but free, moving in and out of their houses of their own free will, free to perceive the passage of the days through the different summer months and the smells and the sun and the rain and the high days and the brooding days, as was their right, without fear and without apprehension. On the front lawn of the White House on the river bank, the two little boys came out every morning and dug holes and hammered nails into boards and pushed around the express wagon filled with rocks. Their skins were filled with the sun, with the season, and they played all day, humming tuneless songs under their breath. Up the road at the gardener's cottage of the big house, where nobody lived, the gardener, who was unmarried, a short, stout man who was a Jewish refugee, tended the borders of the garden and painted the long white fence and worked on the driveway. In the summer morning sun he sang, too, in German, as he did his slow, neat work. In the evenings, after supper, when it was dusk and the only light left was in the red sky on the other side of the river, he would come walking down the road to the house on the river bank to call on the German governess who took care of the two little boys. His footsteps could be heard walking, hard and quick, down the road. Fraulein would be sitting on the stone front steps. He would stop short in the road in front of her, dressed in his clean clothes, his body round and compact, and his black hair brushed down and bow. "Good evening," he said. Fraulein said, "How are you?" Then he would come and sit beside her on the steps, and the conversation would continue in German, because although he could understand sufficient English, Mr. Loeb could talk hardly any. Fraulein was friendly to him because she was a friendly woman, but always a little superior because he was a Jew, and she belonged to a family of small merchants in Cologne. She was sorry for him because he was a refugee, and because he had been in a concentration camp in Germany, and it was necessary to be kind to those who had suffered under that Hitler. But a Jew was a Jew. There were right German names and wrong German names. Fraulein's name was Strasser. She did not mind speaking her mind to him on the subject of the Nazis who were ruining Germany. There were no other Germans about in this place, as there were in the winter in New York, who might be on the other side. To them she had only praise to speak of Hitler, for her family was still in Cologne, and people suffered at home for what was said by their relatives in America, if it came to the wrong ears. But Mr. Loeb was a Jew and safe to talk to tell exactly what she thought of those people, those Nazis. He never said anything much back, just listened and nodded. His face was round and florid. In the evenings, Mrs. Mason, the children's mother, sat in a garden chair out on the lawn and listened to the crickets in the marshes and watched the red fade beyond the river. Or, if it was one of the nights when she could not enjoy the evening sounds, the smells, when a little of the tension and fear clung to her mind and twisted it about, she would sit inside the living room on one of the chintz-covered chairs under a light with a book. She read all sorts of books, novels, detective stories, and the papers and magazines that were full of the news about Europe. On the bad nights, the nights when peace was not quite at her command, she noticed that whatever she read seemed curiously to be written about her, to fit her situation, no matter what it was meant to be about. And especially all the books, the articles about the Nazis. She did not know if it was morbid of her, but she could not help feeling he had stood for the thing that was the Nazis, that spirit, and she had been a country being conquered, a country dominated by those methods. It was so like, so very like. When she read of those tortured in concentration camps, of those dispossessed and smashed to the Nazi will, she knew she felt as those people felt. She had been through a thing that was the same in microcosm. Her life was a tiny scale model of the thing that was happening in Europe, the ruthless swallowing the helpless. By a miracle, by an overlooked shred of courage, she had escaped and was free here. She was a refugee like that man out there talking to Fraulein who had escaped too, by another miracle, for only miracles save people from that spirit. In refuge, peace and assurance were coming back slowly like strength to a sick body, and the fear, the terror that was once everything was draining away drop by drop with the days of safety. The same thing must be happening to him, the man out there. Confidence and a quietly beating heart in this calm summer country where there was nothing any more to fear. Only the habit of fear, only the uncontrollably quickened pulse for no reason, the fear that came out of nothing because fear was a poison in the blood and passed in and out of the heart again and again and again before it was finally worked out, if it ever was. Perhaps she thought it never was. If you were infected virulently enough with that poison, perhaps it never left you, but recurred forever like some tropical fevers, forever part of you and in your blood, though you were 1,000 miles away from the source. He was nearly 1,000 miles away, too, and there would be no reason, no need, ever to see him again. But perhaps the fear would stay with her, though there was nothing left to fear. As the summer wandered by, the young man from across the river came over more and more often to see Mrs. Mason. He had a boat with an outboard motor. She would hear it buzzing across the water, and the sound of the motor cut as he drew near to the dock. There would be silence while he tied up, and then he would come walking up the lawn, very tall, with his fair hair cut short all over, catching the light from the sunset in the quiet dusk. "Hello, Fraulein," he would say as he came up the steps. "Hello, Mr. Loeb." Mr. Loeb always got to his feet and bowed smartly. Fraulein said, "Good evening, Mr. Worthington." Then the screen door would slam, and the sound of German being spoken quietly would begin again, and he would walk into the living room and grin at Mrs. Mason. He used to sit in the chintz-covered chair with his long legs stuck out in front of him, smoking cigarettes. Sometimes he took her out on the smooth, dark river in his boat. Once they struck a log in the darkness on the water, and she started violently and cried out. "What are you afraid of?" he asked her. "You're so lovely. I don't see why you should ever be afraid of anything." It was impossible to explain to him that she was not afraid of the log, nor of the water, nor of anything, that it was only a reflex which she was helpless to control without reason, just fear. "You know I'd take care of you if anything ever happened, don't you?" he said. "If you'd just let me." And she knew he would, but that it did not make any difference. Nobody could help, because nobody could possibly understand the irrationality, the uncontrollability of fear when it was like this, in the blood. Any help had to come from within, the self-learning through days, perhaps years of peace, that nothing of all that which was over would ever happen again. Talking to it was no good. No young man's protectiveness penetrated to it. It had to learn slowly by itself. The young man was falling in love with Mrs. Mason through that long summer, but it was inconceivable that she should fall in love with him. No matter how kind and strong he was, no matter how much more often she saw him each day, how good he was, how there was none of that spirit in him, it was inconceivable that her muscles could ever grow slack enough for her to look at him quietly, a man, and fall in love with him. She had been naked once and vulnerable to everything that had happened to her. Now, and perhaps forever, something in her clutched the coverings of tension, of reserve, of aloneness, having learned what happened when they were dropped. Her mind could say that it would not happen with this young man, who was all gentleness and generosity, but the inner thing did not believe that. It believed nothing except what it had learned. When they sat on the lawn smoking in the twilight, or inside in the big, cool living room, the German talk went on quietly on the front steps. Mr. Loeb was a quiet man, and Fraulein did most of the talking. When she had said her say about the Nazis, Fraulein told him about the children, how Hugh was as good as an angel and Dicky was just so different, a sweet child but always up to something. The big June bugs and the moss banged against the screen door, and the light from the house came soft and yellow through the door and lay upon the stone slabs of the steps. After a while, when she knew him pretty well, Fraulein told him about Mr. Mason, what a bad man he was, and how glad she was that they did not live with him any more. "That poor lady," she said, "she took plenty of unhappiness from him, I can tell you. My, what a place! I can't tell you what a man he was. You wouldn't believe it. She never said anything, but I knew what went on. I don't mean maybe beating her. I know husbands get mad sometimes and beat their wives. That's all right. But that man, I tried to keep my babies from seeing the things that used to happen, and she helped me to do it. Not that I ever discussed it with her. She's that kind of lady, very proud, and I never saw her cry, only heard her sometimes, nights when he was very bad. She had such a look in her eyes in those days. She doesn't have it any more. I can tell you I'm glad she got rid of him. In this country it's very easy to divorce, you know." "Yes," Mr. Loeb said quietly in the darkness. "Well, she's got rid of him now, and I'm glad. It would have killed her, a life like that, and my poor babies, what would have happened to them? She's got rid of him, thank God, and now she can just forget about him and be happy." Mr. Loeb said nothing. He didn't smoke because he was saving money out of what he earned as a gardener. He just sat there in the darkness, and he smelled a little of sweat. Fraulein made allowances for his smell, knowing that he was a laborer. In the middle of the summer, Hugh had a birthday, and there was a big cake with 7 candles and 1 to grow on. Mr. Worthington came across the river for the little party, and both children were allowed to sit up until 10. After supper, Mr. Loeb came walking down the road as usual, and Mrs. Mason called him in. "Won't you have a piece of cake?" she said, holding out a plate to him. "Here's a piece with a candle." Mr. Loeb made his bow and took the plate. Mrs. Mason smiled at him, and he smiled at her, and they did not say anything. "We're going to play games in the living room," Mrs. Mason said. "Do you know any games, Mr. Loeb?" The children were wild with excitement and ran around and around the room. Mr. Worthington showed Hugh a game with a piece of paper and a pencil, where he could guess any number of a total if he knew the right-hand numbers of the other lines. It was very mysterious. Dicky didn't understand it at all, and stamped and yelled to make them stop and do something else. "I show you," Mr. Loeb said, and hesitated. He asked Fraulein how to say something in English. "He shows you a card trick," Fraulein said. Mr. Loeb's face was round and red and smiling. He took the pack of cards Mrs. Mason held out to him and drew out 2 aces. "You see," he said to Hugh, "this is the farmer's cow." He pointed to the ace of hearts. "And this is Mrs. Sisson's cow." Mrs. Sisson owned the big place where Mr. Loeb was a gardener. The card was the ace of clubs. "Now I put them back again," Mr. Loeb said, shuffling the pack. "Now, which cow you want to see? The farmer's cow? Mrs. Sisson's cow?" Hugh deliberated, standing on one leg. "Mrs. Sisson's cow," he decided. "Then go to the barn and look for it," cried Mr. Loeb. The children were enchanted. They screamed and rolled on the floor. Dicky kept crying, "Go to the barn and look for it!" Everybody was laughing. "That was a very nice trick," Mrs. Mason said when the laughter stopped. The children, after a while, fell to playing with the cards on the floor. Their 2 little round butts stuck up in the air, and their 2 little boys' heads were close together. Mr. Loeb finished his cake and took out a folded handkerchief and wiped his mouth. He put the plate down carefully on the desk near him. "Thank you very much," he said to Mrs. Mason. He was still standing up politely. Now he moved toward the door. "Don't go away," she said. "Stay and talk. Sit down, please. You're part of the party." "Thank you very much," he said. "Understand you had a bad time with those Nazi fellows," Mr. Worthington said, being very friendly. "Were you really in one of the concentration camps?" "Yes, I was. It was very bad." "I was in Germany once," Mr. Worthington said. "The thing I kept noticing was they were such damned bad losers. One night I went out drinking beer with a lot of fellows, me and a Frenchman I knew. They seemed all right guys. But about 2 in the morning, when we'd all drunk a lot of beer, one of them said, 'Let's have a foot race.' Down the main street there, it was all quiet. Well, we started, and in a minute or 2 the Frenchman was way in front and I was just behind. They just quit. started walking along, wouldn't admit they'd been racing. But if they'd been ahead, you can bet they'd have rubbed it in. They want to be on top, that's it, and they take it out on the fellow underneath. If they get licked, they won't admit they were playing at all. Yes, said Mr. Loeb. You see fellows pick fights all the time, late at night, but you never saw them pick a fight unless they thought they could win. I played a lot of tennis over there, and of course, you know, American tennis. They just wouldn't play again. Fellow over there would say, let's play a return match and I'll lick you. Not them. Yes, said Mr. Loeb. Those concentration camps now, just the fellows on top doing it to the fellows underneath. It must have been a job keeping your courage up. I did not keep my courage up, Mr. Loeb said. Mr. Worthington looked embarrassed. I don't blame you, he said. The things you hear about those places, they break your spirit, I guess. Yes, Mr. Loeb said. Fraulein sat under the light with her hair parted smoothly from the middle. She looked from Mr. Worthington to Mr. Loeb with self-assured eyes, not entirely understanding nor especially interested. Mr. Worthington twisted his long legs around one side of his chair. Anyway, he said, it's all over for you, and I bet you're damn glad. You can just forget about all that stuff. This is a free country, and you can do what you please, and nobody can hurt you. It's all over now and finished for you. For many, it is not, Mr. Loeb said after a few moments. Yeah, that's right, poor devils. But, Mr. Loeb said hesitantly, I have thought, I do not know how you say it, the more and more that are all the time. Surrendered? How do you mean? He means oppressed, Mrs. Mason said. Mr. Loeb bowed to her. The more and more that are oppressed all the time, the more there are who know together the same thing, who have it together. When it is time and something happens to make it possible, there is something that all of these have had together, and that will make them fight together. And now Frenchmen, too, Belgians, too, Flemings. If you have been in a concentration camp, it is more together than that you might be of different countries. I speak very badly, Mr. Loeb said. No, Mrs. Mason said, a common cause. Please? Mr. Loeb asked. Fraulein spoke to him in German. I do not think that it is what you call cause, just, but knowing the concentration camps together, and what happens, that they were all crying together, and, no, courage. It makes them love. I don't see what you mean exactly, Mr. Worthington said. I do, said Mrs. Mason. They all remember the same thing together. Yes, Mr. Loeb said. It seemed to her for a minute that she saw a sea of faces upturned, with the same look on all the thousands of them, the anguish, the terrible humiliation, the fear. It was a vast and growing sea, a great host of the tortured and the outcast, who had known ultimate fear instead of death, and had been together in the valley of living hell. Separately each of them had known fear, had felt it burning in their veins, but now that they were all together, the common fear became something else, larger, because there were so many millions of them, because they were not alone. It was set in dignity like a brand of brotherhood upon their lifted faces. And there were more of them and more of them. If there were any more, they would be the largest part of all the people on earth. This part would be strong by its numbers and unshakable because of its suffering shared. This was something she had never thought of before. The children were sent off to bed at last, and Mrs. Mason went up to say good night to them. They lay in the two cot beds, holding still while they said their prayers, and then releasing into a last wild activity before the light should be turned out on them. She pushed them back under their sheets and kissed them. When she came downstairs again, Mr. Worthington was sitting alone in the living room, and the German voices were coming in softly through the screen door from the warm darkness outside. "Hello," Mr. Worthington said. "Hello," she said. He reached out and took her hand as she passed where he sat and kissed it. She stood still for a minute and smiled at him. "I love you from now," he said. She went on looking at his face, bent over her hand, but with his eyes looking up at her. After a minute, the consciousness of what he said, where she was, the consciousness of herself came back over her, and she drew away her hand. But for a moment she had lived in freedom without watching herself. In August, Mrs. Sisson came back from California and opened the big house, and Mr. Loeb was much busier, doing all the things that Mrs. Sisson wanted done. Mrs. Sisson was a woman of 50 with black hair and a tall, strong figure who was very particular and liked her big place tended to perfection. Mrs. Mason knew her only slightly, to wave to when Mrs. Sisson drove along the road in her black car with her initials on the Connecticut license plate, and to speak to her in a neighborly way when they met in the village. Sometimes now Fräulein started to tell her things about Mrs. Sisson, how badly she treated all her servants, that she didn't even feed them properly, and had had 3 different waitresses in just the time she'd been back. Nobody wants to work for a woman like that, Fräulein said. But Mrs. Mason thought she ought not to listen to gossip and did not let Fräulein talk about it much. One afternoon when she came out of the house, Mr. Loeb was standing at the gate talking to Fräulein. The 2 little boys were playing at the end of the lawn. Mr. Loeb was talking very fast in German, his voice much higher than usual, and Fräulein was looking at him and from time to time saying something in her usual calm voice. Mrs. Mason walked to the gate. "Hello, Mr. Loeb," she said. Mr. Loeb made his bow, but he seemed distracted. His eyes were tense, and his face was even redder than usual. Mrs. Mason thought he looked almost as if he were going to cry. He turned to her and began to speak in English, but stumbled and was silent. "That Mrs. Sisson," Fräulein said. "She says to him she will report him to the refugee committee in New York so that he will never be able to get a job again." "What did he do?" "Nothing. She talked to him the way she talks to all the people who work for her. She bawled him out. He doesn't paint the fence quick enough. She says he's too slow. He's a foolish man. He pays attention to what she says. I tell him he ought to shrug his shoulders. What does he care as long as he gets his pay?" "I cannot have her speak to me that way," Mr. Loeb broke out. "I cannot have her call me those things she says. I cannot." "He pays attention," Fräulein said. "He gets his feelings hurt too easy. I tell him, what does he care what she says? She's nothing. But he says to her, she can't speak to him that way. He cannot have her speak to him that way. He cannot stay and work for her if she talks like that. So she says, all right, she's going to report him to the refugee committee." "What can she say?" "She was terribly angry," Mr. Loeb said. "She will say I do not work. She will say I am a no good worker. She will say I speak to her fresh." He looked at Mrs. Mason with his frightened eyes, and she nodded at him. Their eyes met, and she nodded again, but more slowly this time. "I'll go up and talk to her," Mrs. Mason said. She did not feel at all afraid to do that suddenly. She was not thinking about how she felt. Fräulein shrugged. "I don't think it makes any difference, you excuse me, Mrs. Mason, that Mrs. Sisson, she doesn't want Mr. Loeb to work for her any more because he talks back to her and she writes the letter anyway." "I'll write to the refugee committee, too," she said. "I'll tell him that I know all about Mr. Loeb, and he's a good worker and a nice man. But I'll go up and talk to her anyway." Mr. Loeb leaned against the fence and looked at her. She came out and walked past him into the road. "Thank you very much," Mr. Loeb said in his foreign, formal voice. She smiled at him. The tension had gone away from his eyes. The look of fear that she recognized had gone. "You don't have to worry, you know," she said. "I wouldn't ever let anything happen to you." And that story was Those Are His Brothers by Nancy Hale from 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, edited by Laurie Moore. The next story is from Sun Fiction American Short Stories, edited by Robert Sheppard and James Thomas. Important Things by Barbara L. Greenberg. For years the children whimpered and tugged, "Tell us, tell us." You promised to tell the children some other time, later, when they were old enough. Now the children stand eye to eye with you and show you their teeth. "Tell us." "Tell you what?" you ask, ingenuous. "Tell us the important things." You tell your children there are 6 continents and 5 oceans, or vice versa. You tell your children the little you know about sex. Your children tell you there are better words for what you choose to call the married embrace. You tell your children to be true to themselves. They say they are true to themselves. You tell them they're lying. You always know when they're lying. They tell you you're crazy. You tell them to mind their manners. They think you mean it as a joke. They laugh. There are tears in your eyes. You tell the children the dawn will follow the dark. The tide will come in. The grass will be renewed. Every dog will have its day. You tell them the story of the littlest soldier whose right arm, which he sacrificed while fighting for a noble cause, grew back again. You say if there were no evil, we wouldn't have the satisfaction of choosing the good. And if there were no pain, you say, we'd never know our greatest joy, relief from pain. You offer to bake a cake for the children, a fudge cake with chocolate frosting, their favorite. Tell us, say the children. You say to your children, I am going to die. When? Someday. Oh, you tell your children that they too are going to die. They already knew it. You can't think of anything else to tell the children. You say you're sorry. You are sorry. But the children have had enough of your excuses. A promise is a promise, say the children. They'll give you one more chance to tell them of your own accord. If you don't, they'll have to resort to torture. And that story was Important Things by Barbara L. Greenberg from Sudden Fiction American Short Short Stories, edited by Robert Shepard and James Thomas. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. Beyond and Beyonder by Matt Hart. Beyond and Beyonder, appearances and depths, the vision looking out is the same as looking in, and what one sees depends on the eyes. Who's looking? Philosophy, it kills us, but it also lifts us up. Geometry, it angles without cutting, through smoke and physics, and wonder do we even exist at all? There are a thousand ways and more to sing and to song. Some days the heart alights in a tree, and others the tree is already on fire. It comes as no surprise, then. What's beautiful is always both crash site and landing, memorial and monument, lighthouse and warning, the sense of our senses both exuberant and dire. In us the wildest bewilderment glistens. The wilderness transforms as the architect explodes. Every single one of us a hymn to achievement, so weird with potential, so wired to wolfishness, illimitable goodness. In life as in art, what's important are the choices, the actions that follow, and the forms as they glow. Let us consider the past as we go, and let us consider the future at our fingers. What do we want for the next generation, and the next generation's next generation? When they listen to our music, when they open our books, remember our wars and treaties and image, will they find there a lightness or an absence where we fluttered? An elegy in which to drown, an ode to something better. This isn't in darkness, but in love. It's a promise. The human predicament is nothing short of marvelous. We get to decide how it goes. And that was Beyond and Beyonder by Matt Hart from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.